All right. Well, I'm going to start the recording now, and I think Deborah will be on her way shortly. But in the interest of everyone's time, we'll go ahead and get started here. Thanks, everyone, for coming to this yet another in our innovation ecosystem module series, specifically designed for newer ILOs and stakeholders or ISLOs or whatever the name ends up being. But this one is being hosted here by Ernie Davis and Tom Dudley, and they're going to give us their expertise on IP and tech transfer, which is, it depends on the center, but oftentimes this is a critical piece for a center's value proposition, and ultimately for sustainability. Some centers, not so much. There's a wide variety of experiences there, which I'm sure they're going to share. So without any further ado, then I'm going to pass it on to you guys. And I understand, Ernie, you're presenting first here.
Yep, I'm gonna share my screen. Can everybody see that opening slide? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. All right. Would it be helpful if we just did a really 30 second to a minute introduction of ourselves, just so if you don't know who we are, would that be helpful?
I think that'd be great, Ernie.
Okay, very good. Well, I'll introduce myself briefly. Ernie Davis, I am the ILO for an innovation director for NEWT, which stands for Nanotechnology Enabled Water Treatment Center. Been with the center since it started almost 7 years ago. And in this area of tech transfer and IP, do have some relevant experience. Worked in two tech transfer offices at two separate universities, and in a startup experience, I was part of my duties involved in licensing of technology and IP management for the company. So that's my part of my background that might be helpful. Tom.
Yeah, I am the former ILO for CellMet. Stands for Cellular Metamaterials. I turned over about a month ago, well, at the end of the year, but John, who is not sure, is on the call, John Hartnett, and I have been sharing it for the past 6 months. So there was a good turnover. I spent years in different roles, mostly managing startup companies in our incubator and big center grants like CellMet. But the 35 years before that or so, I was all in fiber optics and semiconductors. And from the other side, from the company perspective, dealt quite a bit with creating IP portfolios for value and ending those portfolios.
Very good. Thank you. And just an editorial note, really happy to do this presentation with Tom. It's one of his final acts, even in retirement. He's been generous with his time today. So thank you, Tom.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and jump in. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what we're going to share with you today. Three broad areas of discussion with our presentation. So I'll give an intellectual property overview from a lot of different perspectives. And most of this overview is going to have with its focus patents, because I think from an IP perspective, in ERCs, we'll probably deal, most of us will deal predominantly with patents and inventions. But we will talk a little bit about software-related stuff like copyright, and we'll get into briefly trademarks and even trade secrets. We'll go over some of the documentation associated with patent hygiene and intellectual property management, and that includes some documentation and policy-related stuff that you will probably get familiar with if you're not familiar with it already. And then we'll talk about some of the functional things that you'll see within the ILO or SPI role relative to tech transfer. And we'll talk about, in that vein, how we deal with the tech transfer offices. If you don't have experience or a lot of experience with that, then hopefully we'll share some information that will be helpful for you. Okay, so to start off with, just fundamental information about intellectual property and what intellectual property is. I like the definition that was provided by the World Intellectual Property Office, and I'm not sure if it's still on their website, but I nabbed it from their website a couple of years ago when Tom and I did this presentation a couple of years ago, but there's WIPO's definition of intellectual property. Intellectual property really fundamentally is or includes creations of the mind, such as inventions, literary and artistic works, designs, symbols, names, and images used in commerce. So intellectual property covers a lot of intellectual territory. And again, the focus of this presentation will be largely about patents and inventions, but we'll talk a little bit about some of these other aspects of IP as well. And it's pretty cool that in the United States, we have some pretty pretty strong rights frameworks in place when we talk about IP and IP protection. And so look no further than the U.S. Constitution. When we talk about IP, patent, and copyright. And in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, you'll see the following, that Congress has the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times for authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective rights and discoveries. And I underlined a couple of words or terms there because I think these terms are connected, progress and exclusive right. So the quid pro quo in our system and in jurisdictions really around the world includes this idea of you as a patent or copyright holder getting an exclusive right. And in return for that exclusive right, you have to disclose what you've done pretty fully. And with that disclosure, there's a promotion of progress in the system because people can learn from what you've done. So for instance, with patents, you have this duty of candor where you fully disclose how to make and use your invention. Someone else picks up your patent, they give it a good read, and hopefully they learn enough and get excited enough so that they have an incentive with their own patent rights with improvements to go after those improvements and progress the arts and sciences in a specific domain. So a pretty cool system. Nice that our US Constitution has that supportive framework in place. So all that is kind of in distinction and compared to trade secrets. So the heart of our system is disclosure and progress. You can argue that there's progress with trade secrets as well, but not nearly as much disclosure. The whole intent of trade secrets is to keep your trade secrets and the value of it kind of tucked away behind closed doors. Hopefully it never gets out, because if it gets out, your trade secrets really kind of evaporate with broad knowledge of them. So wanted to highlight that that trade secrets, that's a protection mechanism as well. But you can argue that probably rightly that patents especially provide a fairly strong protective right when you compare it to trade secrets, just because your trade secrets can possibly get discovered somehow. All right. And you lose your monopoly with that discovery. So when we talk about patent rights, it's nice to be able to understand what a patent right actually conveys. A patent right really is a so-called negative right or a right of exclusion, which means that when you have a patent and you get rights under your patent, you have the right to exclude others from making, using, offering for sale, or selling or importing the invention that's protected by your patent. So those rights of exclusion are still very powerful, but the patent is not a positive privilege or a positive right that you would get granted under what would be considered like a permit, for instance. You know, when you get a permit, it gives you an active right to do something. In a patent, it's an active right to exclude others from not doing something. So patent rights actually operate a little differently than other rights, especially those permitting rights per se. So we have this idea in the patent world of negative rights and not positive or permitting privileges. But with as a byproduct of the actual legal thing that you get in a patent right, the byproduct is, well, if I can exclude others from making, using, selling, and so forth, that means that if I have that right to exclude others, I can actually do that same thing. And so it's still a very powerful commercial right to have. And maybe I should stop right there to see if there's any questions about what's been shared so far. And by the way, if you do have experience in this area of tech transfer and patents, I forgot to mention this earlier, please feel free to share the information that you do have, because we can all learn from each other. So if you have relevant information, by all means, jump in. Okay, with no questions, I'll move on. So mentioned that we're going to focus our attention in this presentation on patents. And when you do that, you automatically turn your attention to inventions, because inventions are protected by patents. So with this this idea of invention, it can be considered a thing, but also kind of a two-step process. So think of invention or inventing as a two-step process that involves the conception of your idea or invention and reducing that idea or invention to practice. And when we talk about invention, conception, the first step of invention, it's really dominated by this idea of having mental dominion over what you've created, or the performance of the mental part of an inventive act. It is a very critical step in the two-step process of invention or inventing. And there's a couple of court cases out there that can give you some guidance on this term and help you to further define it. I've got those two terms, or those two definitions highlighted from Federal Circuit Court cases in 1986 and 1994. But the real intuition here with both of these cases is you've got to have mental dominion and a concrete formation in your mind of what the invention is. It has to be complete. So complete that if you handed this idea over to someone who's skilled in your area, they wouldn't have to jump through hoops unnecessarily to reduce your invention to practice. Okay, so conception, really important, the first step of invention. The second step of invention is called reduction to practice. And you can have two varieties of reduction to practice. You can have what's called an actual reduction to practice. And so, for instance, if you created a new composition of matter or material, actually making what you've invented or conceived in your head, that's called an actual reduction of practice. But you can also have a second type of reduction of practice, and that's called a quote-unquote constructive reduction of practice. So you don't have to actually physically make something or create something to have it reduced to practice. What you can do is you can have those ideas in your head reduced to writing and file all that writing in a patent application in a relevant jurisdiction that handles patent rights. And once you file that patent application, you have effectively and constructively reduced that concept or that invention to practice through the act of that patent filing. So making something doesn't have to be the requirement for reducing to practice. You can actually write that invention up, describe it, file it as a patent application. And at that moment of filing, you've perfected the constructive reduction to practice. Okay. The really important thing with conception, going back to conception, is that it helps to really determine who the inventors are, especially with collaborative efforts or consortia efforts. Sometimes this area of joint inventorship can get kind of murky. You have, in some cases, the folks who conceive the ideas, but and maybe in that conception, they've had help with reducing what they conceived to practice. So key thing here is that the folks who merely reduce something to practice at the instruction of the inventors who conceived the idea, those folks are not considered inventors or joint inventors. It's only the folks who engaged in conception or co-conception of an invention, they and only they can be considered the inventors. So that conception step, again, is really, really important. Any questions about this area of invention and the two steps involved? Okay, moving on.
Do you in practice just instruct whatever attorneys are preparing the patent to go, you know, kind of take care of that for you? Or do you ever actually get involved in assessing who belongs on the list of names that's going on under disclosure or something like that?
That's an awesome question. So as a general rule, I think everybody assumes good faith when trying to do this determination of inventors so that you list them appropriately. If there is ever a controversy or question, maybe the tech transfer office of the university gets involved in kind of a tentative assessment based on some of the fine points of what they know of patent law. But at the end of the day, to do a really hardcore inventorship assessment, it takes the skill of a patent attorney, because boy, can it get murky. talking about who's an inventor and who. In fact, there's one federal court case out there that outright says a judge is like, of the murky process of determining inventors or determining whether something is patentable, boy, you get down to inventorship and it's the murkiest of all areas where it can be. So having that skill of a patent attorney, if there's really serious questions about inventorship, I think that's where it usually goes.
I think, Ernie, if I could step in, where the ILO may get involved is to make, you know, to help guide some of the inventors, like, hey, that's a pretty good idea. Please see the tech transfer office and fill out, you know, your respective university's technology disclosure form. And then that will get the process started. So I think if there's any role for the ILO in determining whether an invention is patentable, it's just encourage the PIs to fill out their respective university technology disclosure forms.
Yeah, the great, but yeah, and I kind of, yeah, thank you. I think that was maybe the heart of your question, like specifically for an ILO, yeah. You know, relying on the tech transfer office to help, I think, is really helpful. But yeah, directing the folks, as Tom said, to, you know, the disclosure, and so that process can be started if there are questions about inventorship, totally appropriate. Yep. Okay. Any other questions about inventorship and the steps involved in invention? Okay. I'll move on. Hey, Scott, by the way, I don't know if you saw that someone is in the waiting room. I don't know if you're seeing this notice, but I'll go ahead and admit them. Thank you.
I just saw that. Thank you for pointing out to me. He's now in. John's here.
Okay. So when we talk about patents and universities, we from a historical perspective and kind of as a grounding thing, it's helpful to talk about the Bayh-Dole Act. That's the real act that helped to get this area of tech transfer at universities going historically. Before the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, by and large, the U.S. government had the ability to take ownership of inventions that are created with federal funding. And when they took that ownership, oftentimes the issue arose where if the government had a request to license, for instance, a new drug or elements of a new drug on an exclusive basis, there was some hesitation to do that because the idea being, well, this is taxpayer funded stuff. And so we should really take the broadest approach in dissemination of this technology. And so, you know, exclusivity kind of goes counter to broad dissemination. So, whoa, we hate to do that. But in some wisdom of some folks, I guess Bayh-Dole, they kind of recognize that, well, gee, if it takes $1 billion to develop a new drug, you know, non-exclusive rights to a new drug constituent versus exclusive rights is almost like a non-starter if you don't have exclusive rights for certain things. And so that kind of helped the Bayh-Dole Act to come into existence. And also some people claim that the Bayh-Dole Act really gave birth to the biotech industry, for example, for those reasons stated, granting exclusivity for change. And so really important milestone here in the United States for technology development and commercialization, where under this act, now universities can take title to their inventions and they can also license those inventions even on an exclusive basis. A few obligations associated with this right and parenthetical privilege. One of those being that you have to share royalty income if you do license. You have to share royalty income with the inventors who invented the technology at your institution, among other things. So a really important legal milestone again in the United States for universities. So some real high-level information about the different types of IP. I'll touch on copyright just a little bit. We'll spend a little bit more time on patent stuff. But copyright, it protects original works of authorship. And the key thing to remember here is that copyrights protect really the expression of what's in your head or in your heart, in the case of music and literature, maybe. So it's that expression. So if you have ideas about something software related, it's the expression of that software in coded forms, the code itself, that's protectable with copyright. And also other aspects of software can be protected with copyright as well. But code we talk about often as being protectable. And with those exclusive rights, the best with copyrights, the right to reproduce, distribute, create derivative works, publicly perform and display, really critical rights that you get with copyright. So with patents, talked about this a little bit earlier about the rights of exclusion that you have. But you do get what many people construe and consider to be broader rights with patents, because you can protect more the underlying functions of your invention as opposed to just the expression of it in coded form, for instance. And so protection of things like processes, machines, articles of manufacture, compositions of matter, even designs and plant varieties, all those things are the domain of patents. I highlight at the bottom of the screen here, I won't go through each detail of this slide in the interest of time, but when we talk about claims, what really defines the legal boundaries for you in your patent, those are the claims. Claims are really, really critical. Sometimes we can overemphasize claims if it's possible to do that. Usually the claims read on the detailed description of your invention, also called the specification. And so both in combination are important, but when we talk about patents, usually claims will come up. So we wanted to emphasize that here. Also on this slide, just want to mention one critical turning point in the US system as far as patents are concerned. It's 2013 when we went from a first to invent system, which was kind of unique in the world, that patent system. And we migrated in 2013 from that first to invent to a first inventor to file system. Again, aligning us with most jurisdictions around the world in that first inventor to file system. So essentially, with first inventor to file, you're in a race to get your date, your filing date for your invention, get it on record at the patent office before someone else, perhaps with a similar invention, files first. Okay, it was a big change in our system. I'm not doing it justice in the interest of time. A lot to unpack there if you really wanted to get a lot of information. It's worth going through that. But again, key thing here is 2013, big change for us in our patent system. Now we're on a first inventor to file system, very consistent with other systems around the world. And before we turn it over to Tom, just wanted to highlight software for a minute because and I'm not going to go through each detail of the slide. There's a lot here, but with software, it really does highlight some of the intersection, what could be the intersection of both copyrights and patents. And to talk about software, in some cases, you can make some distinctions between the two types of IP at play within that one technology framework that we call software. So I mentioned earlier that software code can be protected with copyrights or with trade secrets, but we often talk about copyrights as well as being protectable with software. But also the underlying functions, the systems, the methods of software, they could be protectable with patents. But the thing you have to watch out for with the software is this idea that your software can't be a collection of abstract ideas in a software package, in a software medium. The courts have tried to understand exactly what it means to have abstract ideas tied to your software. Briefly, if you have software that embodies fundamental economic practices, methods of organizing human activity, pure mathematical relationships, for instance, those things are way too fundamental and quote unquote abstract to be protectable under patent law. And so more often than not, you're going to get a patent rejection if you try to go after that stuff and protect it. This is a growing area still. Again, a little bit murky when we talk about software patents. Also, another area that's kind of connected principally and conceptually is business method patents. And so interesting to dig into if you love legal stuff and the patent world. And lastly, I'll talk briefly about trademarks. Trademarks protect words, phrases, symbols, and some designs that make your product distinct from another. And so one of the big things that you watch out for with trademarks is trademarks help us to alleviate problems of commercial confusion and commercial and product dilution. And so if you misuse a mark, usually that misuse takes those two forms. It either causes confusion in the marketplace the way you've used a mark inappropriately, or it dilutes the value of your products that are partly derived from the use of the mark in the marketplace. Okay? Okay, so hopefully that introductory information about patents and other types of intellectual property was helpful. Now, Tom will help us with biotech challenges.
Yeah, sure. So besides John, are there any other IOOs that are with centers that are life sciences connected? Well, I know Chris is, but. All right, so it doesn't sound like too many are. So I'll go through this quickly then. For those that might have issues related to biotech, I think a good resource, Scott, would be Cindy Sundell at Georgia Tech, because they faced a lot of the same issues that, you know, I'm not sure we faced them, but could potentially face at CellMet. So, you know, the challenges here are that the biotech field is very research intensive. There's a high cost there, but even though it's a high cost and long development cycle, it's pretty easy to imitate. You know, you get confused between basic and applied research. It's often interlinked. And one of the things that as someone that's always been involved in companies that build stuff and had created things, you know, it's kind of odd for me to see that a lot of academic research has led to spinoffs, but these spinoffs, in fact, the IP rights are their only product. And there are, especially in the Boston area, there are a number of startups that all they have is some IP. And there are, in, you know, especially in this area, you see companies, most of the large pharmaceuticals have outside or groups that look for outside of their company research. And they just go around either funding academic research or creating alliances of these spin-outs. So it becomes very valuable. There is a high cost, long development cycle, long regulatory cycle. So that kind of shortens your window where you can exploit that invention. But if you get past all that and you have an invention that gets patent protection and you form a company around it, well, next slide there, you have something that's very valuable. And so that's the goal here on the biotech side. So maybe the next slide, Bernie.
Tom, can you be just slightly more concrete about the IP or the product? You mean, is this a new molecule?
Yeah, let me go. I'll go through examples on this page here. Okay. That first slide was just to hit challenges. Let me go through some examples here. So the patent, what is considered patentable, does vary by country. Some of the things that are not considered inventions are natural living things. The ERC I was associated with, CellMet, was geared toward developing engineered cardiac tissue products. All right, so the cardiomyocytes, or the cells in a cardiac, in a heart, are not patentable. You may have, one of the things that we found is that in the chambers of the heart, the cell types vary by chamber. There's, I don't know, 11, I forget now, but multiple different cell types. There is a certain proportion of those cell types chamber of the heart that is patentable. Could be patentable is if you can minimal set of cells or minimal arrangement of cells in different proportions that could restore viability, that may be patentable. So it's a fine line there. the process for creating cells. If you've come up with a process to mature the cells, mature the tissue, so that the tissue is more sustainable, that is something that is patentable. But the tissue itself is not patentable. So you have to look at very specific, you have to look at each invention and make sure that you've defined it. It's not, it has to be material not found in nature. Either the proportion of the material is not found in nature, itself is not found in nature. Specific molecules, specific cells are not patentable, but how you create the cells may be. So I'm not sure if that helped, that example helps out any, but it is an area that gets a lot of attention. The last item I have there, composition of matter is king. If you determine, like, a heart is not patentable. Maybe I should give a better example. If you have a salad is not patentable, but the elements of that salad, maybe the tomatoes, the lettuce, whatever else is in the salad, olives, those things can be patentable. So where a heart is not patentable, it makes specific cell types, could be if you those cells in certain proportions or learn how to mature those cells so they are more sustainable, live longer. Those type of things are patentable, but not the end product there. It has to be elements of it. Next slide, Ernie. All right, so this is more general, and maybe this follows on some of the items that Ernie may have said. The timeline for a typical patent. Typically, after your respective universities make an assessment as to whether an invention could be patentable, they'll make a determination on how to file that. So it may be, if you're filing in the U.S. only, they would file maybe a provisional patent. And that gives you, once that application is, provisional patent application is filed. By the way, you're not filing a patent, you're filing a patent application. Once that's filed, if you're only filing in the U.S., you have up to a year to turn that provision filing into a non-provision or utility patent application. Now, there's another, so I'll just leave it there. There's another thing, international filings. You can file what they call a PCT patent, provision, patent something treaty. What does it stand for, Ernie?
It's cooperation treaty.
Yeah. So you could file it there through WIPO. That can be filed anytime within a year after you file the provisional or your national filing. And generally, it's up to, it could be up to 30. If you do it that way, if you file WIPO filing, you could have up to 30 months to file your national filing for a non-provisional patent application. So there's a timeline there. There's an examination period that could take up to 3 to 4 years. Now, it all depends. The examination period really depends how well you define your initial provisional patent application or your initial application. There's a lot of theories around, or a lot of strategies around this. And I'm sure most of you have come across this already. One strategy is to file as many claims as possible in a single application. Another strategy is to file an application for each claim. You know, the thought is if you keep the claim smaller, it can go through faster, but you're spending a lot more money. And then also the speed at which your particular patent application is reviewed and ultimately have an issue all depends on how it is written into it. But really takes time. I think maybe the next slide is in Ernie.
Hey Tom, can I ask a question right back to that slide?
Yeah.
Thanks. So I think maybe for me and some maybe more established ones that have witnessed this, and maybe I just want some clarification from you and Ernie and others, is I think it's pretty easy to understand. Yep, I filed the patent pending, the 1 year clock is rolling. Okay, after that, close to 1 year, the inventors, the licensing department, maybe even the ILO is kind of in the room saying, okay, do we want to go for the full patent? Then they can decide how much money to throw in, right? I don't know if some centers have money, some centers don't, whatever else. Now that 3 to 4 years to get true actual the patent done, I've seen it where it's in that process and then the licensing department just decides, nope, we're dumping it. And then
that could happen, yeah.
And that can happen, okay. And so, because as I'm doing my reviews of patents, all of a sudden I see like UCLA says, yeah, we dumped it. I'm like, well, did you guys try to go for the whole patent and then that got dumped? And I guess from maybe our point of view, you know, do we really need to watch that? Is it a bad assumption that once you start filing for the full patent that it's going to get there? Is there anything the ILO can do to keep that thing going? And are you kind of kept in the dark as far as some of these decisions as the 3-4 years go by? I'd love to get Scott's and maybe Ernie's and yours kind of thoughts on that.
Well, I'll try to answer it. And I'm probably going to give a lot of answer probably beyond your question a little bit, Chris, and then let Ernie chime in. First of all, your tech transfer offices at the universities have a fixed budget, have a certain budget. Correct. And they got to work within that budget there.
Yep.
So they cannot, for every technology disclosure made by the PIs, they're not going to be able to pursue protecting every single invention. So they have to make calls. Those calls are, you know, get input from us, or from the ILOs, you guys. And, you know, how do we get the input? Well, checking with our industry members. So you have a view on what may have commercial success. And again, you have to be careful of what industry members say too, because, you know, there's a conflict of interest. They want to say, yeah, file for the patent, but I don't see any commercial interest, because if they do the negotiation stage, they don't want to say there's a big market for it. So, but you have to take input and you give the input to your tech transfer office.
Yeah.
It's important. It's important. I think you want to do the right away, and then you have a year to decide. Yep. One of the things found is that, and I have some later through. One of the things we found, if it is important to industry members, they're going to support it, and they're going to encourage you to pursue it. And in those cases, the university won't drop it. And in all cases, at least from what I've seen, the university tech transfer office will always ask the inventor, or I know at BU they get back to me, but at the university, they will get to the inventor and really ask them whether they think it's important or not. And generally the inventor gets back to someone like the ILO, and the inventors want to patent everything. So they're going to go around solicit support and they're going to get back to the ILO. So you'll have input, but I think it comes down to the tech transfer office has a certain budget and they got to work within that.
Yeah. And just maybe one more thing to add on my end. So with that budget in mind, it certainly helps when you do have an entity paying, other than the university, paying for that patent filing. And in some cases, some ERCs may have processes whereby if there is a request from an industry member to file a patent application, because of the expense involved, they may say that, sure, you can ask for it. And you also have to, if you want, for instance, an option right to negotiate a license to this IP, once you've made the request to file, you also need to pay for the patent application filing. And so some processes do have that. I think Tom's going to talk a little bit about more process stuff. So
yeah, I have a slide in the process steps a little bit later, Chris, that I'll go through an example that of how CELMET did it. It's an example. I mean, other universities can vary.
And then I guess maybe this will maybe help answer some of the questions on the 3 to 4 years. Does the cost of filing that full patent happen all at once, like at the beginning, or is it spaced out?
Actually, go to the next couple slides.
Okay.
You know, before we leave the slide, can I just chime in, because this might help Chris also. It's at CNT, once the provisional is filed, and sometimes it's like pulling teeth to get the faculty to even do that piece. But once I get them to do that, and I've got that year clock starting, that's where I pound the pavement with the industry members to say, hey, we've got this cool thing. How interested are you? And when that year expiration comes up and the tech transfer office is having to decide how to spend their limited funds, if I can show them that there's 3 or 4 industry members that are hot to trot for that IP, that helps them pull the trigger. In fact, sometimes they need that to be able to pull the trigger to plunk down the cash for the full patent. But companies like Medtronic that you work with, Chris, in particular, they like to license IP rather than having something that was got a provisional and then the university dumped it and now it's kind of out there in the public domain. Maybe now a grad student has published on it. It's murky. Medtronic doesn't like, they're very conservative. They don't like to jump into something where it's not super clear who owns it. They would rather pay for licensing to avoid a 5 or 10 years down the road, someone suing them for patent infringement. They hate that, and understandably so. And that's a much more costly case. And they're willing to walk away from good IP to avoid that costly lawsuit if it's not clear who owns it. They would much rather help the university make the decision to patent it and then plunk down the cash to license the patent, because it protects them later on down the road in their R&D development. Just for what it's worth, because I know you work with Medtronic a lot. That's what my experience has been with them.
Okay,
the cost. Maybe the prior one. So yeah, there's a lot of costs involved. But if you go to the prior slide, Ernie, there. You can stop there. So generally what happens is the next one, I guess, actually. Generally what happens is, I'll just run through it. So the steps are, the first step is, the PI goes to the tech transfer office and says, hey, I have this invention. Can it be protected? The tech transfer office generally will, what they'll do is there may be a conference where the PI is going to speak at. You want to protect it before you have a public disclosure. So generally they'll take that invention and file a non-provisional patent application. That's relatively inexpensive. If they think it's a really, really good invention, they may take time and write that provisional patent up very precisely with, very, very nice claims. But it'll generally done right away and relatively cheaply, just to get it protected so that the PI can make a conference presentation. Let's go to the next step. All right, so they decide I am going to file a patent, a full patent application, a full non-provisional patent application. So that does take money, all right? And so that is filed. I'm not sure where you are, Ernie, here, but you see, that is filed right away there. There's a legal, the during that first year, the attorneys will make a legal assessment as to the patentability of the invention. They'll search prior art. They'll give a patent. They'll give an opinion on the patentability of the invention. That costs money. You got to pay the lawyer for that. They'll file the application. Again, it costs money, lawyer fees. After reviewed by the patent office, there may be additional action. Again, you have to pay your attorney. There may be the how well you get past the patent office all depends on how well the claims were written in the initial patent. So it really makes sense to invest the money with a good attorney, spend your time and really write the patent claims very clearly, as broad as possible, but very clearly in your initial, in your patent application, your utility application. You pay more upfront for that research, and that, but it pays off in the long term, because once it gets to the patent office, you may have very limited actions to respond to after that initial review there. And the more reviews, the more questions that come out of the patent office, it's just going to cost more with attorney fees as you go along there. Eventually, if it was written really well, you will get a patent issued. It will be allowed and there will be a patent issued there. Any step along the way, this is Chris's question, any step along the way, your transfer office will may make a decision like, hey, it's just not worth pursuing here, either maybe on the advice of the attorneys, or maybe just looking at the cost of it, the commercial potential. They make a decision just to abandon the process. And you have input on that. Like we said, it could be abandoned anytime. By the way, that's only for U.S. If we're only filing U.S. By the way, any claim, if you file only in the U.S., Ernie talked about the rights that were enumerated in the Constitution. Well, those rights only pertain to the US, all right? If you want to file internationally, then you're paying your lawyer a lot more money. And as the slide says somewhere, Ernie, you're paying the lawyer's international friends a lot of money too. But it does take a lot of money and it's a process. Now, kind of to give you a comment that it's not that bad, depends how well you write the initial patent application. Right before Christmas, I went out to dinner with a couple of folks from our tech transfer office just to say goodbye. And I asked them how fast things were proceeding. And at least on the Boston University side, we were getting notices of allowance within 12 months of filing the non-provisional patent application. It probably is related to two things, but probably the most important was how well the tech transfer office wrote up the claims and prepared before they filed the application there. So that's important. You spend money up front, but it pays off on the back end there. All right, so maybe go to the slide that says confidentiality. Right there. One of the things, and this gets to be that's more practical, what you're gonna see all the time. We are working, all the ERCs are working on research with commercial potential. The ILO role is the prompt to really encourage the PIs to go to the tech transfer offices and fill out their technology or venture disclosure forms. Different universities have different terms for it. You have to remember, as an ERC, you want to make sure that you protect an invention before you disclose it. Now, the ERC is considered a closed body. So if you're disclosing information among your members, that's okay. It doesn't break the rule of public disclosure because you are a closed body. To protect that kind of closed body, if you have any visitors to your meeting, you have to make sure they sign a non-disclosure agreement. The other thing is, I think it's really important to be training your staff. Their research should be protected. One of our partners, University of Michigan, will not even allow their research files to be stored on Dropbox or Dropbox, I guess, folder. It needs to be stored on university servers. That's how closely they protect it. And you gotta encourage, you have to make sure the students are aware of the value of IP. I mean, you can't have students kind of like that farmer's insurance thing, that where they have disasters and they say, we've seen it before because it happens. Well, don't have your students take pictures of their research and show it on TikTok from their among friends. That's not the way to go, all right? They have to know that. They have to know they need to protect the IP, what they're working on. So confidentiality is important. And they are going to be publishing papers, or if they are going to be making any presentations at a virtual or in-person conference, and if there's any potential in what they're presenting is an invention that should be protected. Well, we need to take those steps before they make the presentation. So I think that's an important role of the IOO. All right, maybe next slide, Ernie.
Okay, I think this is where I pick it back up, Tom.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, and Scott, how are we doing on time? Do we just have a couple minutes here?
We just have a few minutes, yeah. Not a lot of time for Q&A, but if folks are able to stay longer, then we can do that.
Okay, I'll try to make quick work of this section because I think we covered a lot of this already. So maybe a couple of things that might not be as obvious if you've never worked with the tech transfer office or the tech transfer function in your institution. So the two couple of primary things they do, they definitely are the folks who are kind of the stewards of intellectual property and the management of IP, patent filings, patent prosecution. We talked about that. Tom talked about that. So they take the lead on behalf of the institution for those kinds of things. Also, if you have an industry member, for instance, that wants to negotiate a license to some of the IP being generated at one of your academic institutions in your center, the tech transfer office will lead the charge in terms of negotiating that license. Not the easiest thing to do in some cases, especially for very, very valuable IP. And so, for instance, maybe there's a negotiation involving one of your industry members with one of your institutions. To understand just the mechanics of what your tech transfer office does to, for instance, price a technology so that it can be licensed at all, a few different techniques they use. Some institutions use pretty heavy-duty quantitative analyses, some not so much. Some use industry standards. I think good approach is all of the above, quantitative, rules of thumb, industry standards to kind of triangulate your way to a financial term sheet that makes sense for all parties involved. And so just kind of knowing the background of what's going on in the negotiation from that perspective might be helpful for you as an ILO if you happen to have an industry member that engages in a negotiation with one of your institutions. You'll kind of get a feel over time for what's a fair deal and what's not a fair deal. And if you run into something that's not representative of a fair deal, then you might be asked to help smooth those edges, if you will, in those negotiations as an ILO. Also, the thing that might come up is sponsored research negotiations. And so the IP part of those negotiations falls right to the lap of the tech transfer office. So from time to time, just to understand the mechanics of that IP transaction, part of the transaction for sponsored research negotiations, Might you get a call if your industry member is saying, hey, I don't get it. They turned down all my proposed terms and I don't know why. Being versed enough to kind of understand the mechanics of IP negotiations for those sponsored research contracts might come in handy. But those are just some of the additional things that a tech transfer office will handle. And you perhaps will work with them in some of this stuff as an ILO. I won't go into too much depth about the challenges of university tech transfer. I guess maybe the overriding thing that we probably all understand is this is really early stage stuff. How to manage really early stage stuff can be a challenge. How to protect it and what level of investment you make for IP for really early stage stuff when there's so many questions to ask commercially, it can be daunting. And so just understanding that much, I think will help frame conversations for you if they come up with your tech transfer office and your university inventors. One of the other conversations that might come up as part of your IP process as an ILO is identifying routes to market, the appropriate or the many varied routes to market for the IP of interest. So, you know, is it a big company play, small, medium-sized company plays? Is it a platform technology allocated for a startup? Probably is the most logical format for it. Lots of different questions to ask. Your IP management plan in your center will dictate kind of these routes that your technology will take or your IP will take. And in some cases, for instance, if you have, I think this was mentioned by Tom on one of the slides, or maybe someone made a comment about this. What if you come up against a situation where you have a technology that is of interest from a startup perspective with a research team, but at the same time, that same technology has to pass through the center's IP plumbing so that it's offered to some or all of your industry members who are paying members of the center? What do you do with that? So being aware of these possibilities, understanding what to do in certain cases where you run into some of these issues and some of these route to market questions with your IP, very, very helpful to understand these things ahead of time if you're an ILO. Okay, so really quickly, mentioned licensing. Anatomy of a license, probably the thing to be most familiar with if you're talking license stuff with your industry members or your tech transfer office, if licensing comes up, term sheets and financial consideration at play in the deal. Could come in the form of upfront fees, running royalties, and also very important patent cost reimbursements. These are the things that tech transfer offices like to see. Having a sense of what a university fair deal is and isn't really important, because perhaps one of your industry members again will feel that in a transaction, your university is not being fair. And to unpack that enough to understand how you can be helpful in mitigating those weirdnesses that can happen in these discussions and negotiations, understanding financial deal terms and the expectations on both sides, really, really important. Okay, Tom, I know that was very, very quick in the interest of time. Just wanted to cover as much as possible there. Sorry about that, Tom.
Again, I'll go through quickly center IP policy. First, in any IP policy, you have to set up definitions. So define what your members are, what your industry members, what your academic members are. Next slide. Types of IP. Of course, anything funded by NSF funds is core IP. We also define anything funded by membership fees is core IP. We have a seed. We use member funds to fund seed projects. Any of the output from those seed projects becomes center IP as well. Anything outside of that, if a member is funding sponsored research outside of the center, then that is not considered center IP. So define those definitions up front in your how it pertains to your particular situation. Next slide. We have different levels of membership. Different levels of membership also have different levels, and it looks like here they all have the same. They have certain rights to IP, and we define it you can see the chart here, but define the rights that each level of membership would have to your IP. We do have a tier where our highest level of membership does have the first shot at taking a license, and then it goes down from there. But there are exceptions. Okay, this is a flow chart on how we run it, or how it, I used to run it in Selmet, and I think how John Hartnett is continuing to run it. But this is a typical flow chart. What we do is, on a quarterly basis, Selmet identifies IP that identifies inventions where we made a first filing, whether it was a non-provisional filing in the US or a PCT filing, whatever the first filing was. It could be provisional, non-provisional, or PCT filing. The first filing, at the first filing, we notify our members. And so it's done at the end of each quarter. So there could be an invention that we made a decision to file on that, like in January. At the end of the quarter, March, we add up all the inventions from that quarter. One of them could have been from January, and we disclose that to our members. I can't use the arrow because I think you're in control here, but so that's the IP notification in the center there. Once we notify the IPAB, they have 6 months, 180 days. We call that a reservation period, to give us an indication as to whether they want to exercise their rights to take a license. And then we have a first option period, second option period. They relate to offering that to lower tier members or any other member if negotiations didn't go correctly with the first member. Now, we do, to the point that Ernie made a little bit earlier, what do you do, or how do you handle, and this is probably an important thing, how do you handle a PI that made the invention that wants to form a company around that invention? We allow them to form that company and join the center as the lowest tier member and give them equal rights to that invention as a higher tier member. Now, we say equal rights, the IP office has to make a determination. We don't write this down. And this is one of those things that we leave it up to the respective tech transfer office to make the decision as to how that invention can best be commercialized. All right, the larger company may have the financial resources to exploit the invention, but you know, the invention is only as good as the inventor or the knowledge that went into it. So it may be that, okay, the small company formed by the inventor may not have the financial resources, but has the expertise. So it's a balancing act. And we try to favor the spin out from the university. It may irritate the larger company. We've never come into that situation to date, but that's how we work it. It's an unwritten rule, but it's in there. All right, next slide, Ernie. Just some important things here. All the inventions belong to the home university, the PI. They don't belong to the center. That being said, regardless of which university invented, whoever the home university of the inventor was, all the notifications to our IPAB members go through the ILO. So those quarterly notifications are made only by the ILO. If there is interest by any of the members in taking a license, then the respective university tech transfer office would be the one negotiating it. It's not a Selmet thing. That being said, one of the other things that we defined up front was a royalty sharing for the ERC. Generally, different universities work it differently. I'll just give BU as an example. At BU, 1/3 of any revenue you get from licensing goes to the university, 1/3 goes to the department, and 1/3 goes to the inventor. What we did up front in our IP policy was said that the 1/3 that goes to the department, half of that or 1/6 of the total needs to be turned back into funding for ERC related research. And these were terms we put in our IP policy, and all these terms are deployed to our academic partners through a subcontract. So everyone agrees to it. Now, it's not like an imposition on any of the partners. Talk to the tech transfer office at each of the universities ahead of time and came up with a policy that everyone agreed with. So it was mutually agreed to. All right, next one, Ernie. Not addressing the IP policy. You guys are going to come across this all the time. There is no center IP fund to support the application or prosecution process. There is no center. It has to be determined by each respective university office. We talked about that. One of the things that I think is we have not been able to address, I think it'd be nice to address, but it relates to how you handle your IP. The IP is valuable, is more valuable if you could take it as a portfolio. It is very difficult to get 4 or 5 different universities to agree to create a portfolio. We can see, we have elements of it. We have, for instance, one of our partners, University of Michigan, has done a very nice job of creating portfolio around printing technologies. And so that's great. They have a core there, but we haven't been able to create a portfolio around the biology aspects of the center. And because it involves too many universities, it's just very difficult. The terms of any licensing deal are not in the IP policy for the center. That's all determined university by university. That discussion I made just a few seconds ago about how we try to prioritize NSF's desire to kind of promote small businesses. Well, that's a determination we make. We don't automatically grant it, but try to make an assessment as to the ability of a small company founded by one of our PIs can exploit innovation better than a larger company. And you have to be careful because some larger companies are only licensing for maybe defensive purposes. So they don't have an intention to commercialize it.
Tom, let me just interrupt you. We're going pretty far over time. And so are there maybe bullets that you can share? Because we'll send these slides out to the group and so others can read the stuff that we haven't hit. But maybe just a couple of bullets of summary.
Yeah, hit the next one. Let me see if there's anything important on the next one there. I guess the only comment I have is make friends with the tech transfer offices. I probably connect with those folks more than anyone else on the IL. Everything I do I used to do on the ILO job was independent, except with IP-related items. Make friends with those folks, not just in your own university, but all the university partners associated with the ERC. What's the next slide? That's probably it, I guess.
Tommy, you're right. I for my home institution, I take those guys out to lunch once a month, and it's $20 well spent. And then for the other institutions, whenever I'm there, I make sure to at least stop by, if not take them to lunch, because you're right. That salves a lot of issues that could happen having a good relationship with those guys.
And one other thing, in terms of documentation, and you guys probably have all figured this out by now, we don't have each university partner sign non-disclosure agreements. BU signs on behalf of CELMET and all our partners in CELMET. That's how we wrote the non-disclosure agreement. So if you haven't already figured it out, I think that's an important thing to mention also.
And maybe one other thing from my perspective, you know, IP generated in a center, even if an industry member doesn't take advantage of that infrastructure for IP licensing and commercialization, it still could be very well that that technology is just really early, but in a few years, maybe it's attractive. It's just ahead of the market right now, but in time, it becomes really important. And so continuing to understand the value of that IP generated in your center for the purposes of licensing and commercialization by folks outside of your center, including non-members of your center, still a very, very important aspect of what you do, because perhaps an IP could be really important and it could reflect very, very well in your center for the long game. So just wanted to mention that as well.
Absolutely.
All right, well, good luck, everyone.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't get time for Q&A, but I imagine Ernie and Tom, you guys are around, and Stephen has some deep IP experience as well. I'm just gonna volunteer him also if folks have questions to reach out. And would you guys, Ernie and Tom, send me your slides, however you wanna revise them for posting on the ILO website, and I'll get those up along with the recording of this call for folks that couldn't be here. But Ernie and Tom, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
All right, have a great day, everyone.
Take care.
Take care. Thank you.
Hey, guys.